Welcome to Local Matters. I'm your host, Jeremy Wendt, here with Dr. Derek Edwards from Tennessee Tech University. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good, good. So tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do at Tech.
So I'm an assistant professor of psychology. I've been with Tennessee Tech full-time since the fall semester of 2012, tenure track since the spring semester of 2020. I teach all type clinical courses in our psychology department. I'm also a licensed professional counselor, so that's my formal training.
A few of the hats that you wear.
Yeah, one or two.
And there's a few more that we'll definitely talk about. So with an education twist on local matters, which is kind of obviously my specialty area, I always ask everyone who your favorite teacher was growing up.
So if I think K-12 favorite teacher, it was second grade. And his name was Tim Hamilton, Mr. Hamilton. I had never had a teacher, and I mean, it's not like I'd had many by the time I got to second grade, but he was the first teacher that I had ever experienced who was just like bubbly, I guess would be a way to say that, okay. Like real passionate. And one of his things that he would do is read stories, and he would always use voices to read the stories. And like, he didn't matter if he looked like an idiot. I loved that, you know? So much so all the way up until around junior or senior year of high school, that second grade class would get together every October for a bonfire and Mr. Hamilton would be there as well.
Wow. Yeah that's fun.
Really inspirational guy.
Yeah. So did you carry over any of that to your current teaching today?
I like to be very monotonous and dry and make sure that my students never engage. Yeah, I think he taught me the power of a story, even at the second grade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun to have a male teacher because obviously it's uncommon to have a lot of male teachers in elementary grades, but a lot of people really respond to that. It's something. The female teachers are wonderful.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's fun to have a male teacher in an elementary classroom.
Yeah, it was a neat almost like a paradigm shift for what. What was even masculinity, you know, and here's this clear man educating us as children. Like it was really neat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. Okay. So how did you get to, and again, I know it's a fun path and there's a lot of twists and turns, but how did you end up in education, teaching in the counseling and psychology department?
You know, I'm still trying to figure that out. If you would have met me my first semester of freshman year, which was at Tennessee Tech, right? If you would have met me and said, hey, one day I bet you'll be a college professor, well, you would have been a poor judge of character because there's no way you could have known that. My first GPA was 0.4. Like there was no number in front of the point, by the way, right? I was a student who excelled pretty easily in high school. So much so that I thought I was just going to excel easily in Tech's engineering program. One of my best rules, which I don't recommend to any of my students, I wouldn't go to the first 2 weeks of any course.
Oh.
And then just try to figure it out afterwards. So I thought the 0.4 was pretty strong after that. But I was an engineering major, and I just did not like it. You know, and I did that up for 3 years. I had found the fire service, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, a little bit later. And it became apparent I didn't want to be an engineer. I didn't like the coursework and I didn't fit in. You know, it wasn't one of those things. But I took a general psychology class with one of our grad school professors now, Dr. Mark Loftus, who was just an adjunct instructor, I guess, teaching Gen Psych. And it was like every class was for me. It was one of the most bizarre experiences of my life. Huge lecture hall in one of those engineering quad buildings from the olden days, you know. It might have even been Clement Hall. And it was the one class I never missed. It was the one class I didn't take notes, but it's like I didn't have to. I could just write it out as soon as he was done. So it became apparent I was going to change my major, so I had to call my mother and tell her that I wasn't going to be an engineer. And she said, I wondered how long it would take you to find that. And I was like, well, you could have said something, you know? You know? So switched to psychology and just fell in love with that idea. Still had no plans on working as faculty or in education. I worked as a case manager. I sold nursing homes for a while. I took a job as a crisis worker, answering calls. So I was going to get my PhD and got a phone call from Dr. Sherry Foster, who was one of my professors in grad school. And her words were, I need to meet with you at the library tomorrow. Look, I'd already graduated, so I thought she was going to rescind my degree. Like, I didn't know what was happening. And I said, I'll be glad to meet you, Dr. Foster. You know, what's going on? And she said, oh, you're going to come work at Tech. I was like, oh, okay. You know, yeah. one of those things. So we met at the library. I had a meeting with Barry Stein, who was the chair at the time. And he offered me an adjunct position, and I told him I couldn't accept that because my wife was pregnant, and I'd just taken a job literally the day before that had insurance. And he just waved his hand and said, oh, come on full time. That was the summer of 2012. A series of serendipitous events that are made possible by making connections with people. Not trying to angle people, but truly having human encounters with people is how I think I ended up where I am. And I couldn't have planned it, but I wouldn't do it differently.
Yeah. And many times that's the way it works in education. Mm-hmm. You know, you follow your passion or what you think is your passion, and then those people just find their way into your career path instead of you seeking it.
Yeah.
Many times.
It's almost a paradox, right? The harder you look for that career path, the more distant and nebulous it becomes. But the more you just engage with those things that bring you passion, I think that passion's contagious. And that's what brings those other people into your sphere, right? Mm-hmm. Now they see that passion, they see that area, and they genuinely want to help and share in that. And it leads us to these next steps. It is I think for me, one of the scariest parts of the direction of our education system is trying to pigeonhole or lock these students in at younger and younger ages for what they want to be when they grow up, when quite honestly, they don't have all the facts. Mm-hmm. They don't have a clue of what's even out there. And we can't have enough career fairs or career days for them to be exposed to all of those types of things. So I think that's a concern I have for the future.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. And I had a director of schools on a few weeks ago, and that's one of those positions, one of those things where he says kids aren't in fourth grade saying, I want to be a director of schools when I grow up. You know, it's a path that people end up in because a million reasons.
Right.
But it's not something. And so, you know, there probably aren't a lot of kids who just set out and say, oh, this is what I'm going to do. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up.
I'm just not going to grow up. That's my goal.
Yeah.
I was called to a preschool last week. It was last Tuesday, and they wanted me to talk to the kids about being a counselor. And I thought to myself, Derek, you're an intelligent person. You can do this. Let me tell you, I was wrong, right? Because try to explain counselor to a four-year-old. You know, we talked about feelings, and they asked me some great questions. For example, what is my favorite color? Uh-huh. What is the name of my mother? You know, very relevant to my career. But man, to think we're at career day at this preschool, mm-hmm. and they don't have a clue. What if they just focused on being instead of aiming?
Mm-hmm. Spoken like a true counselor.
Well, don't tell anybody.
Along the way, yeah. So, okay. So some of the classes that you teach. Let's talk about those just a little bit. So just day to day. So freshmen, right? Freshmen, juniors, seniors. Where do you spend most of your time?
So I almost exclusively teach upperclassmen at this point. First several years, it was Doug Hensley and I just doing Gen Psych, and I think together taught every student at Tech. But then when I took the tenure track position, and a little bit before that, I had shifted to teaching mostly upper division courses. So probably the course that I think students associate with me the most is psychopharmacology. That's kind of for those who are brave enough to take it, they realize pretty quickly that it's going to be okay. But I love psychopharmacology. It's kind of the background with EMS, you know, working on the ambulance. I love that kind of aspect of our human existence. I also teach therapeutic techniques, which it gives some students some basic skills about what it means to be a therapist. And it also helps our students who are thinking maybe they want to be a therapist moving forward, a chance to practice, because it's not for everybody. And I'd rather you find out now than now you're enrolled in grad school and you start. It's a fallacy, but we start to feel like we've got this buy-in. Well, I've already committed, so I must, which isn't true, but it still feels that way. So those are probably my two biggest courses. Also, have recently brought back a health psychology course, which I enjoy a great deal. And I spend a lot of time teaching abnormal psych.
Okay. Yeah, it's a broad spectrum. We have a lot of psychology majors at the undergrad level, but typically most students go on to some type of grad school after an undergrad for their career.
Typically that's the route. So, you know, psychology is a science, and we are teaching our students to be expert researchers or excellent potential for research in their future. And sometimes that's a little bit of a rub for what people think psychology is. You know, believe it or not, counseling is not considered psychology. It is an applied use of psychology in a clinical setting. So we get a lot of students who think, I'm just going to learn about, you know, counseling. And to reframe that is pretty helpful. Now, we're going to teach you to critically evaluate concepts, ideas, and apply that evaluation to the research methods.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more Dr. Derek Edwards from the Counseling and Psychology Department. And welcome back to Local Matters, here with Dr. Derek Edwards from the Counseling and Psychology Department at Tennessee Tech. Welcome back.
Glad to be here still.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So tell us a little bit. So I know that you're into a lot of different programs, a lot of different work with neuroscience is one of the directions that you're getting into a little bit more.
Yes.
Tell us about the cockroaches. I think that's such a neat thing. And I've actually saw a news story about some other research with cockroaches.
So we're trying to expand some availability of coursework to our students. And the field of neuroscience is obviously a very broad field, but specifically using it as a way to teach the physiology of psychology to help students who want to go that path. We do have several students who want to go that direction. The problem with neuroscience research is it's typically dependent on very, very, very expensive equipment, fMRIs, hospital settings. Most neuroscience programs are embedded within a medical school, right? That's just not where tech is. Mm-hmm. So we found this program thanks to our new chair who came in who did comparative psych. So he studied rats. He introduced me to this company. They're called Backyard Brains, and they have these really fun neuroscience experiments that are aimed at not only helping our students at the university level, but even at the younger levels. So the STEM events that we host are Fab Fridays and Safari Saturdays. Being able to get psychology, which is a STEM discipline, embedded into those programs just to kind of expose children to this idea. So the roach is called Robo Roach, and it's a little backpack that you deploy onto the roach, and it links to an app on your phone. And if you want the roach to go left, you simply swipe left, or if you want it to go forward. So it becomes a little remote control roach, right? Simply stimulating different parts of its central nervous system so that we can get the response we want from that. Using applications like this, we're able to show our students and younger students, you know, the power of what's above your neck, right? So this idea of what's going on within your brain, though very different than a roach, works on a similar principle.
Mm-hmm. So what are the long-term implications? Because I know in education, in higher ed, and even in our department, sometimes we just get something because it's flashy and fun.
Right.
Without going much more in depth, but I know there are a lot of implications with that in terms of research and things that could happen if you really figure that out and put some time into it.
Yeah, so really excited about a couple of avenues that we can go with this, specifically with the Backyard Brains. We actually launched some pilot study last week with Dr. Stephanie Wentz's teaching science course to evaluate future teachers' efficacy in teaching neuroscience. And what we suspect and what we're finding on kind of some preliminary results is that when you ask a future teacher, how well do you think you can teach neuroscience? They say, not well, not well. Yet now let's give them some of these interventions. Let's show them some of these things that we can do to look at some muscle control for these robotic arms that we have. Let's show them things that they can implement in their classrooms, and then let's see if that improves their efficacy. What I suspect that we'll find is that we're going to dramatically improve their efficacy because now we've given them some of that knowledge. Not only have we given them the knowledge, they're going to have the skills that can use that, and that's going to really assist their future classes. For our students, it allows a university that doesn't have that type of funding source, like a medical school, to get some lab light materials, right? So the application, I can lecture all day, but if you ask any of my students, do you want to hear Derek lecture all day? I would imagine they would say no. And if they didn't, it's because their check was in the mail, I guess. So here's a hands-on application. We know that you're going to learn better if you're engaging with the material more than just trying to listen to the material. And I think that that's going to radically enhance what we're doing as a department, teaching those types of courses.
Mm-hmm. And showing that hands-on, because it's we hear, and I know psychology is such a broad term, but we hear and we think classical thoughts about psychology. You know, it's
right.
It's someone who's talking to someone else, and you know, it's something that's oversimplified.
Right.
You know, but there are so many different arms and fields and things that can be beneficial. And obviously, having those discussions and those activities with students in the classroom, third graders, could introduce them and get them excited about the field.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, one of the little kits that we've purchased that we're going to use in the 2025 STEM events is called RoboArm. And it's a little sensor, like I think like an EKG, like you get the little sticker on your chest, that two of them go on your forearm or one goes on the back of your hand. And when the student flexes their forearm, it actually causes that robotic claw to close, right? Simply using the signal, harnessing that signal that's firing in our forearm and allowing it to operate a robotic arm. Well, the implication there is far beyond this fun robot toy, and it deals with the world of even prosthetics, animatronics, and how we can use assistive technology and better equip those who might have a physical disability with these types of things. And all of that's possible because the kid can see it. Mm-hmm. If we start using what we know, especially third graders are going to have, even more so if we get down to the kindergartners, if we start looking at that divergent thinking ability that these kids have before we tell them there's one answer, right? When they're willing to think of all things as being possible, when they grow up, they want to be a plant, you know, mm-hmm. like at that area, we can really start to spark some passion in them that might carry over into various disciplines, not just in the world of psychology.
Right, right. And then you can carry that over because there's so many other integrations with science in third grade or with math in third grade or
absolutely
with creative writing. I mean, you know, there are so many other ways to integrate that because it's essentially, it's a STEM activity.
Right.
But it's just coming from more or less the psychology side.
Yeah.
Which I think gets overlooked in terms of the STEM disciplines. We all think of engineering and math, yep, and technology, but then I think a lot of times psychology is overlooked.
Well, our pilot data would actually support what you've just said. And in fact, we gave those students in that course, we gave them a list of disciplines and had them select which ones belonged with STEM. Psychology was an option, not an often clicked option, but it was an option.
Yeah. 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 So that'll give you somewhere to move towards,
yeah,
in some areas. So now will you expand, I guess, will you incorporate some of this into other areas? You know, how far do you see the neuroscience spreading at Tennessee Tech?
You know, it's hard to know right now in this infancy stage. What we do know is that the courses we have that can benefit from it already are going to be health psychology, psychopharmacology, and a course called brain and behavior. Of course, that's just limiting to those very clinical specific courses. We have courses in social psych, which already use biofeedback, this kind of reading the metrics of the body as we evaluate different aspects of physiology, and using these products within all of those types of areas, I think is a no-brainer when we can. If we can get hands-on, then let's get hands-on.
Mm-hmm. Across the coursework.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a novel idea when you talk about it, but the reality of it is that it's so much more effective,
yeah,
to have those hands-on activities.
Oh, 100%. So you ask, yeah, ask any counseling student, where did they grow the most as a counselor? And it wasn't during my theories lecture, right? Mm-hmm. I was in practicum and I had a difficult patient and I was stuck and I had to work through that. Well, that is the hands-on for the counselor in that moment.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back to talk a little bit more with Dr. Derek Edwards from Tennessee Tech. Welcome back to Local Matters, chatting with Dr. Derek Edwards from the Counseling and Psychology Department at Tennessee Tech. So we've talked a lot about psychology, counseling and psychology.
It's probably appropriate.
Cockroaches.
Lots
of different things. I wasn't going to leave that out. But I know that almost in your second life, alternate world, there's a lot of firefighting that goes on.
There is.
Tell me how you got into that first, but how it intertwines with what you do today at Tech.
The story of how I got into the fire service is a very long story that you don't have time for.
Okay, we'll keep it under 12 minutes.
20 years ago, actually, this November was 20 years. I joined the Putnam County Fire Department. I had never been a firefighter. No one in my family had ever been a firefighter. So there was a series of serendipitous events that include a randomly assigned roommate my freshman year living in Browning Evans. And it was another one of those aha moments, like, oh, yeah, I should do this, you know, and that worked. So I became a fireman in 2004 and then became an EMT, went to Tech. At one time, Tech had an EMT program. So I was in undergrad doing classes, and then I took night classes to get my EMT license through Tech. And I got licensed in 2006 with my EMT license. So I'm still an advanced emergency medical technician, so I work on an ambulance and a fire truck when I'm not at the university.
Okay. And that's how do those two worlds cross? How do your two worlds? Because I know they collide.
They do headlong, right? So, and sometimes students will ask, you know, if you had to do one of them, you know, which one would you do? And I said, well, don't ask that because you'll put that in the ether, and then I don't like that at all, you know. One of my very first calls as a firefighter, it was apparent. Now, again, back then, still an engineering student, had no thoughts yet about being psychology. It was a very difficult call, but it was a call that there were, I mean, just no resources for. You know, there wasn't really anything. Now, what's happened in the world of mental health and firefighting since then, over the past two decades, has been remarkable. But in 2004, 2005, not a lot of people talking about the mental health burden onto our emergency responders. So when I find my way into psychology, all of my research, there's only one project throughout my undergraduate time that didn't relate to emergency responders. So my senior thesis from Tech was looking at post-traumatic stress disorder symptomatology, as well as comparing life satisfaction between emergency responders and kind of like salary matched individuals. My master's thesis looked at physiological response to stress in paramedics. My doctoral dissertation was prediction of suicide risk using a series of metrics, as well as understanding burnout. I love to study fire EMS, right? So it's this thing that I can't imagine not doing. And I've been really blessed at the university that they've allowed me to start the responder health lab. So in our lab, we study all things emergency response, so which includes fire EMS and law enforcement. We study suicide to cancer and some happy stuff in the middle, right? So mm-hmm. kind of all aspects, even sleepiness is something that we evaluate. Trying to understand the burden of the profession is a passion, right? So I still work as a fire EMS. I volunteer as a firefighter as well. I'm also a fire chaplain. Having those experiences have profoundly shaped who I am as a person, and it shaped me in a very positive direction. Yet there's so many emergency responders who it shapes in a different direction, and trying to mitigate that, you know, to slow the rates of suicide, to educate firefighters on the dangers of known carcinogens that exist all around the fire hall, all around their gear, all within these IDLH atmospheres, and to give them some meaningful steps so that they can be, you know, healthful retirement. That's my passion above all, is helping this population.
And there can't be a ton of responder health lab research environments. It seems like at the university, I can't imagine, you know, every university would have a program like that. It's got to be fairly unique.
There are not many of us who do this. I believe we are the only psychology department with one. The others exist in the world of epidemiology. And then there are some that exist within the kind of like med school, looking at occupational medicine and those types of things. So we've been fortunate to work with several other universities. We are a part, my lab's a part of something called the Firefighter Cancer Cohort Study, which is a 30-year longitudinal study involving 10,000 firefighters nationwide, assessing their cancer outcomes. So we went out to local departments looking at blood and urine, collecting those samples, shipping them back to University of Miami and then University of Arizona, as well as Rutgers, enrolling these departments, and currently now building a resource hub for these firefighters.
Okay. Which is, you know, it's easy. I think it's easy to not think about all of the dangers
sure.
that come with being a first responder, you know,
yeah.
And so just paying attention to that, evaluating that, looking for answers, you know, even just assessing it is a big deal. I mean, there are, you know, you're our first responders, you know, you're the people saving our lives. But then I think a lot of that stuff gets overlooked and neglected.
Yeah. You know, it's a responder will show up on your worst day, but that's their every day. Is witnessing that. And some of the benefits that we get as just kind of everyday people, the responder doesn't have that ability. So there's something that happens to people called a just fallacy. And the just fallacy is that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. And responders, after about 5 years, recognize that the just fallacy is a fallacy, right? That good and bad happen to good and bad people. So we can't see that pool in the backyard as just a pool in the backyard. Unfortunately, our brains won't allow us to do that. We very vividly remember the pools, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the most benign things can really shape who we are. When I'm going around talking to these different departments, which is what I do a lot, I travel to different fire-related conferences and different departments talking about the mental health impacts of the job. The way I get buy-in from the firefighter is I'll say, if you've been in the field longer than 5 years, when you go out to eat, your family doesn't ask what chair you want to sit in anymore. And you can just see that click in their brain, like, why do I sit with my back to the wall? And it's like, well, you have a part of your brain called the amygdala, and your amygdala has been shaped over 5 years of responding to emergencies, and it can't help but try to keep you safe. And I'm a G.I. Joe kid. Knowledge is power, right? So giving that responder knowledge about what's going on in his or her brain to help them understand that they aren't losing it crazy, they're not all of these broken things, that they're human, actually empowers that responder to heal quite well through traumatic events. The most common outcome of a trauma isn't post-traumatic stress disorder, it's post-traumatic growth, right? Mm-hmm. And we see this time and time again, but if we think that our response to trauma is being deteriorating or being broken, then it does lead us down that disordered pathway.
It's a lot there. So what type of resources are available to first responders, firefighters, when they are experiencing some kind of grief or mental anguish
sure.
or depression due to the job?
So I'm a volunteer member of what's called the Tennessee Disaster Mental Health Strike Team. We're a group of peers. There are a few of us who are clinicians, but the vast majority of the strike team are other responders, fire EMS and LEOs. And we will respond upon request of that department. So let's say that something really tragic occurs within a department. You know, we're going to send a team just to kind of let them know what this looks like and then give them a chance to process that traumatic event. All of my students, if you were to ask them what's like my trigger word, what's the word that'll make me the maddest? It's the word avoidance. And they will say, or you have the right to change their grades in Ireland, that they must avoid avoidance at all cost, right? By going to these departments, by allowing the processing of this traumatic event, we are avoiding avoidance, and we're trusting that in time the brain will process that. So within Tennessee, there's a volunteer network of people willing to respond. Luckily, now we've got more online options for people. There are lots of books, self-help guides. If you're a union firefighter, there's the Center for Excellence up in Maryland that you can go to for free. We have other centers that we send people for if they're dealing with drug and alcohol abuse or they're having suicidal ideation. The amount of resources now is unbelievable compared to what it used to be. But I'm biased, right? I think there's not enough, right? There's not enough. On the Responder Health's website, a responder can find information about cardiac risk, cancer risk, and behavioral health risk. They can also access what's called the Firefighter Cancer Decontamination Toolkit, give good videos, SOP, SOGs for their department so they can reduce the risk of cancer within the fire service. So just real meaningful activities. Keep in mind that roughly 66% of all firefighters within the United States are volunteer. So these departments don't have access to, you know, million-dollar budgets. In fact, there are local departments here in the Upper Cumberland whose annual operating budget is $500. So giving them high-quality, meaningful, impactful, free resources is something that the Responder Health Lab will continue to do as long as I'm allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that you're actively seeking grants and funding sources and you know, also any way to help keep that going.
Absolutely. Forever searching for more external funding. We've been very fortunate to date. So since 2020, a little over $500,000 so far has come into the Responder Health Lab. We have another $60,000 that's supposed to go into effect starting this spring. We just put in for $1.5 million grant, but we weren't funded. But the reop for that is going to be in March, and we'll continue to push. If this is something that we can do to help, then why not do it?
Sure. And it's an important piece.
Think so.
Yeah. We've moved a long way from your favorite teacher to the Responder Lab and all those different things. But it's a great connection, and I appreciate you coming by and talking through all these topics today.
Thank you for letting me be here and for talk about the stuff that I care about the most.
Absolutely. This is your host for Local Matters, Jeremy Wendt, signing off. Thank you.